Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Yesterday's shooting here in Charlotte that left several people dead and injured, including members of law enforcement, is on the minds of many in our community this morning. This program will spend tomorrow's hour to tell you what we've learned in the interim about that shooting and its aftermath. You can join us at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning for continuing coverage of that incident and, of course, throughout the day here on WFAE News and WFAE.org. But this morning, the North Carolina General Assembly's short session began last Wednesday, and though it sometimes isn't short, House Speaker Tim Moore would like to make it so. He set a goal to have it done by July 1st. Could that have anything to do with his run for Congress? Although these short sessions are generally used to make tweaks to spending and other budget items, there's a long list of things that might get their moment in this session, and we're going to go over all of it, with or as much of it as we can, with two politics watchers. Colin Campbell is the Capitol Bureau Chief for our sister public radio station in Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill, WUNC. And Dr. Chris Cooper is a professor of political science and public affairs and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. Morning. Welcome to you all.
Great to be here, Mike.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Welcome back. Colin, the General Assembly's short session, I think, began last Wednesday, if I'm not mistaken, and House Leader Tim Moore would like it to be short. He wants it out by July 1st. That's probably because, as I said, he's running for Congress. So are these short sessions normally short?
That's the goal, the standard approach. In an even-numbered year, as they come in late April, they're supposed to leave by the end of June. Oftentimes, it drags on longer. I mean, the key goal is that they have to make some adjustments to the budget based on the new revenue numbers. Usually, that means they can afford to spend more money than they thought they did a year ago in the second year of the budget cycle. And that process, depending on how well the Senate and the House are getting along over their spending priorities, that can be a smooth process that lasts a couple of months, or it can drag on for months and months, which is what happened last year during the long session, which got even longer than it was supposed to be because there was just essentially extra money to play with, and the House and Senate Republicans couldn't quite get on the same page about exactly what they wanted to spend that money on.
And that may be the case this year. There's a lot of extra money to spend. They have a $1 billion surplus. And I read yesterday, Chris, that these short sessions are usually longer when one party controls the legislature. Why would that be?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of strange, right? You'd think that maybe you'd have this kind of issue of each party's going at each other, and that's what would extend it. But it's really the opposite, right? It's sort of an embarrassment of riches. And this is where you get these divisions, I think, like Colin talked about very well, between chambers. So, of course, we're used to talking on this show lots of other things in American politics about Democrats versus Republicans. But what you often see in these kinds of situations is the House versus the Senate, right? This kind of interchamber disagreement. And the way that often plays out, at least in these short sessions, is every now and again, they'll adjourn right around July 1st, like they say they're going to do. But then they have these reconvene sessions. So if we grab 2022, the last one of these even numbered short sessions, yeah, they stopped on 7-1 and then they came back in July, August, September, October, November, and you know it was coming, December also. So I think you know we could be here for a long time.
These disagreements between chambers, it kind of mirror images the Congress, but it's understandable in Congress because you have two senators from each state and they're representing a wide area, whereas you have these district Congress people who are focusing in on their home district, which is usually generally very small in comparison to the Senate. But that can't be said of the state Senate and the state House, can it? Why such a disparity in opinion?
You know, I mean,
usually
part of it.
Go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I mean, part of it, and Colin will jump in and add to this, I hope. But I mean, part of it is just the culture of these chambers are very, very different, right? I mean, the House Just to grab kind of a fun example, the House tends to be okay with these symbolic bills, right? They will pass a Moravian cookie bill every year as long as they can do it, and the Senate every time will say no, right? The Haywood County is the elk capital. I mean, they're just, these chambers work in very different ways, and part of it is 120 folks versus 50 folks, right? So the Senate is much more disciplined. Senate leadership tends to exert much more control than the House. So just culturally, they're very different. And I'm sure Colin will jump onto that with lots of good insights.
Yeah. So the, we had the same leadership in both the House and the Senate for, you know, pretty much almost a decade now. Tim Moore from Cleveland County in the House, Senate Leader Phil Berger from Rockingham County on the Senate side. And they've got slightly different angles of conservatism that they prefer. Usually Senate Leader Phil Berger and the Senate go for a much more conservative budget. They want to spend less. They want to put more money into savings. They want bigger tax cuts. Whereas the House wants kind of the same things, but at a lower scale. So they're a little bit more towards the political center on some of these issues. And that's where you get a lot of that tension when it comes budget time.
You may have heard that there's an election this November. And although I would imagine that the Republicans in the House and Senate, the state House and Senate, are expected to keep their majority, possibly even their supermajority, there seems to be, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Chris, there seems to be some sort of urgency to get some things done other than just tweaking the budget. Is that because just in case they lose their supermajority, or just in case the heavens open and they lose their majority, they want to put their stamp on things before it's too late? Is that what's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely what's going on. Look, they've got everything right now, right? They have the supermajority. Roy Cooper's veto is worth about the same amount as, you know, my veto or Colin's veto or your veto, Mike, right? It just isn't that important. They can override it by just having their party on their side. That may very well flip. I mean, it is the narrowest of narrow supermajorities. So absolutely, I think part of it is they might lose a supermajority. Part of it is also, this is the last time that a number of these folks are going to be able to do anything in the General Assembly. Tim Moore, of course, being number one with a bullet on that, right? He's about to leave and go be a member of Congress from North Carolina and leave the General Assembly. So if he wants to put his stamp on the state, he's got a few months to do it, and then he's done.
And there's a lot of things that just didn't cross the finish line last time around, like the ICE immigration bill, several other things that they want to get moving because they wanted to do it last year and just ran out of time.
So North Carolina has this $1 billion plus surplus. So there's money to fund some of the things that we're going to be talking about this hour. But Senate Leader Phil Berger says he doesn't think the state should spend the entire surplus and that he'd like to focus on one-time costs that won't tie up funding over the course of many years, like roads or bonuses. And House Leader Tim Moore wants to spend it on school vouchers and the state's Medicaid program. Boy, that's a switch. So first, why do we have this $1 billion surplus? And in the past, when we have had surpluses, how large have they been and how have they been used, Colin?
Yeah, so this is we're somewhat of a surprise because we've been hearing from economists for a while. We're potentially going into an economic downturn. There's a recession just around the corner. And so last year's budget was sort of concocted with that reality of, well, we need to recognize that larger economic picture around the country. That hasn't happened yet. So when all of us paid our taxes a couple of weeks ago and the state started counting up the revenue it was getting, it actually came in much higher. So now we're looking at, more than $1 billion more to spend in the fiscal year that starts in July than they thought they were going to have. And the result of that is that they do have more to work with. But that's been sort of a consistent trend. You know, as long as the economy is doing pretty well, we typically see these surpluses. And a lot of times what they'll go towards is they do try to focus on these one-time projects so they're not stuck funding the same thing year after year. So a lot of it goes to water and sewer infrastructure projects, different sort of pet projects in different legislators' districts. They're not necessarily as much geared towards the teacher and state employee pay, which of course is a big issue because you have a huge amount of turnover, the labor market being what it is. There's like a 20 or 30% vacancy rate in a lot of state agencies. So there's a big push to do more for teachers and state employees and their pay. But if you do anything other than a bonus, you're stuck paying for that year after year, which with a one-time surplus, lawmakers tend to be a little bit hesitant to do stuff like that.
Chris, we have this $1 billion bonus in South Carolina. Not so many weeks ago, they discovered a whole pot of money that they didn't even know they had, and they didn't know where it came from, but they've got it. I'm sure that we are not alone in having a surplus because, as Colin said, the economy has been pretty good, but Republicans are out on the stump for Donald Trump saying the economy's awful. How do they make these two things jibe?
You know, I mean, it's a great question, right? I mean, there's a lot of ways to look at the economy, right? It's this kind of massive thing. And so, yeah, if you look at these state revenues, you're going to say we're in great shape. But I think if you had any kind of Republican operative on the show today, they'd say, well, check out your gas prices and things don't look so good. Go to the grocery store and things don't look so good. So I think when we think about how the economy affects elections, how the economy affects voter decisions, we need to remember it's more about perceptions of the economy than it is the economy themselves. So I think what we're seeing is both parties trying to manipulate those perceptions to highlight the parts of the economy that look good for them. And if you're the Republican Party, the thing that looks good for you is a bad economy. Hmm.
So, Colin, one of the things that they're planning to take up in this short session is the further expansion of opportunity scholarships. These were already expanded. They opened the door to anybody, any student in the state who wanted an opportunity scholarship could get it up to a point, but demand outstripped supply. In other words, they ran out of money in that with using the first tier of students available. So there's a proposal to add $300 million to the pool of money that funds those scholarships. Is that likely to happen?
It's sounding like that's the one perhaps certainty that we're getting, because both House Speaker Tim Moore and Senate Leader Phil Berger have said that's a big priority, that they would like to get that to where all of the thousands of people who applied for these private school vouchers are able to get them regardless of income. Because the way they set it up, when the program first started, it was geared toward lower income families, people who couldn't afford private school, if not for some help from the government to give them that opportunity, as they say, to attend a different school outside the public school system. Last year, they made a decision to get rid of that income cap. Anybody can apply. You can be as rich as you want to be, and you still are eligible to get these vouchers. But the priority goes to folks at the lower end of the income spectrum. So when they took in all the applications earlier this year and started to dole out the voucher money, they ran out of money once they, as you mentioned, got through the first tier, the lowest income families. And with an additional $300 million or so, they believe they could serve all those families. And of course, I think that's going to be a huge partisan issue. You've already heard Governor Roy Cooper speaking out pretty forcefully against this as essentially just putting money in rich people's bank accounts. People who are already sending their kids to private school, can afford to send their kids to private school, are now going to get a nice break if this funding is approved and everybody who applied gets one.
Well, here's precisely what Governor Cooper said last week.
Republican legislative leaders are promising to give away hundreds of millions more just to make sure that the wealthier North Carolinians can pick up their government checks for children that they already have in private school.
Is he spitting into the wind, Chris?
I mean, to some degree, sure. I mean, this is, I think, likely going to happen. I mean, this is, it's pretty clear, right? The writing's on the wall. The Republicans have a supermajority. I think, as you covered a couple of segments ago, they may lose it soon. I think they're going to capitalize while they can. And the reality is, this is something that I think has sold pretty well with a lot of North Carolina voters. I think the Republicans know that. I think they're going to lean into this issue, not away from it.
But Colin, I don't know, maybe you can't answer this question. What is the thinking behind opening the door to these scholarships to anybody without any means testing? In other words, if your parents make, $500,000 a year and they've got two kids and they've already got their kids in private school, as the governor said, why do they get a check to help support their efforts to put their children in private school? They don't need it.
What's Republicans have the philosophy that the money should follow the child in education. The idea being that if the government is going to spend $5,000, say, per child per year, I don't know what the exact figure is. It may be more, maybe less, that the parent should decide, is that money going towards a traditional public school? Is it going towards a private school? Or is it going to a charter school of some kind? And of course, that's their argument. The argument you hear from the Democrats is that by diverting this money towards private schools, you're, imperiling the already underfunded public school system, which is going to, negatively impact the kids that are left in that system, because not everyone has the choice of a private school. If you live in certain rural counties, there may not be a private school within 30 miles of your home, and you may not have transportation to get there. So it's not 100% a level playing field where every family in North Carolina has this menu of,
And if everybody has a scholarship, there won't be enough seats in private schools. We have to take a break at Charlotte Talks on WFA. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the short session, which began last week in the North Carolina legislature to tidy things up monetarily and also to look at a couple of other things that they want to get done. Dr. Chris Cooper joins us from Western Carolina University, and Colin Campbell is Capital Bureau Chief for WUNC. Chris, Colin was talking about these opportunity scholarships and the different viewpoints. Democrats think that this is going to destroy the public school system, and Republicans believe that the money for education ought not to be going to systems. It ought to be going with the children, and they can take it. It's called backpack funding. They can take it with them to whatever school they want to go. And you can believe that or not, but I'm just curious, are the Democrats at all right about this? Will it hurt public education? And is this stemming from some of the things that we've been hearing about over the years that come from this organization called ALEC, which does have it out for the public schools?
Right. So I'll sort of grab the last part of that first. I mean, absolutely. This is a good example of the nationalization of state politics. What we mean by that is that if you look at a bill introduced in North Carolina, and then you look at a bill introduced in Wyoming or Colorado or New York, you're going to see it's going to look like it's copied and pasted, right? We're final exam time at the university. And for some of these, if I saw that bill, I'd say, well, that's plagiarism, right? But that's the way this kind of thing works. That's the way state politics works today. There are national organizations that write model bills. As model bills are shared throughout the country, Republicans do that, Democrats do that. If there were any third party members in the General Assembly, they'd probably do that too, right? So absolutely, this does come in a lot of ways from ALEC and some of these national organizations. As to whether it will, you know, destroy public schools, I don't know. I think that's a little bit, maybe a hair outside of my purview, but I think we're going to see that argument more and more and more, right? And I think it's not just about, part of it is about the definition of what is a public school, right? So I think a Republican who's on the show would probably pop back at that and say, no, I'm trying to improve public schools through school choice. Obviously, the Democrats are going to vehemently disagree with that. So I'm not going to tease out who's right and wrong there, but just say I think
well, the argument does, of course, the argument doesn't make any sense. You can't improve public schools by giving money for private schools. You're not improving the public schools. You might be improving educational opportunities for students. That's an argument that can be won, I suppose. But these vouchers, as I understand them, Colin, will not pay the full freight of tuition at most private schools. So you'll have to supplement that with your own money, and the poorest of the poor will not be able to do that, which the argument goes, they will be left behind in the public schools, and the public schools will have been left to dwindle because the $300 million that they're talking about appropriating for expansion of these opportunity scholarships is $300 million that could have gone to the public schools. And then, given the demand for these scholarships, which has outstripped supply, which is why they want to come back to the well and put $300 million more into it, that indicates that there may not be enough seats in private schools to accommodate everybody who has a voucher. Is there any conversation going about any of these things among legislators in Raleigh?
I think this is going to be the debate you're going to be hearing as we go through this budget process. I would be would not be surprised if the voucher debate is not the central debate to this year's short session and the budget process that we're going through. I think you are going to hear that concern. You know, the thing with the way the school vouchers are set up, there are some private schools that set their tuition based on the amount of the vouchers, and those typically are religious schools. Some of them are Christian religious schools. Some of them are Muslim religious schools that can be sort of subsidized by a religious institution and therefore set their private school tuition to try to attract folks who are trying to use their vouchers. On the other hand, you have the, you know, ultra ritzy top tier private schools where that private school voucher, it may, you know, essentially be a discount for a family, but it's going to be nowhere near the amount that it costs to go to one of these schools on an annual basis. And so that's sort of the tension you've got. At the same time, you've got funding needs from other public schools. I spoke with a teacher who's actually running for state legislature up in the northeastern into the state of rural county, majority Black, very poor, about the different things that his schools can't offer. The middle school can't offer much in the way of arts education, electives, things that, you know, an urban school district or would be taken for granted. And that's something they'd love to have funding to do. But if that's not, you know, top of the priority list on the legislative side, they're not going to get that funding.
If the idea is to give children money so they can go where they want to go, that indicates there's a feeling, you can extrapolate from that, that there is a feeling that the public schools aren't serving these children and therefore they deserve and need other opportunities. And that may be true, but the schools in North Carolina have been chronically underfunded. And 35 years ago, the courts said so in the Leandro case, and so far not a dime of that money has been released. And they said you're underfunding and you're not following the constitutional mandate to fund public education. So why, instead of doing opportunity scholarships and creating charter schools, why not fix the public schools if they think there's something wrong with them? Fund them, change the rules, let them operate the way the charter schools operate. Why has that never been an option, do you think?
I think the Leandro case has turned into this sort of partisan power battle between Democrats and Republicans, between the legislature and the courts, over who has the power to set what that dollar figure is to properly fund the constitutional mandate to provide a sound basic education. And so I think there's some reluctance to sort of follow those rules because they're coming from the judicial branch, and the legislature views that as sort of a, you know, infringement on their powers. But I mean, I think what you see is there's this demand that Republicans are reacting to among parents who, you know, it's a lot easier for them to say, you know what, I don't like my neighborhood public school, I would like to send my kid to private school, than to sort of drill down and figure out, well, what does that neighborhood public school need to be better to where the parents would be happy with that? It's a much more complex discussion than just, you know, do I have the option to send my kid over here instead?
Meanwhile, Chris, Governor Cooper called for a budget that would include 8.5% raises for teachers in the public schools, along with retention bonuses. He's also asked for a 5% raise for state employees and a $2.5 billion bond referendum for public education. Mecklenburg County just had its own $2.5 billion referendum for public education. Senate leader Phil Berger didn't say no to the idea of these raises.
I'm not opposed to us looking at salaries for teachers and state employees.
Politically, in an election year, would he have been unwise to say anything else, Chris, particularly in light of the fact that we have this $1 billion surplus?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was sort of a perfect statement politically from Phil Berger, right? He said, I'm not opposed to. He didn't say I am for. He didn't say here's the rate that I think that we should adopt. He never said, and nor would he ever say, I agree with Roy Cooper, right? What he said is, yeah, I'm open to the idea of giving some people some raises, and we'll see if he follows through on that. We'll see if the General Assembly follows through on that with their budget. Of course, the way this works is the governor starts the budget process. The idea is that he starts the negotiation there. But of course, the reality in a supermajority world that we live in today is that the governor's veto, which they print out and give to these legislators, is very valuable if you need a doorstop somewhere around the legislative building and you just can't possibly find one. It just doesn't mean that much in terms of legislation.
I could be wrong about this, but I think I'm right. So correct me if I'm wrong. And that is that for the longest time, North Carolina was viewed by the rest of the country as having a superb university system and a pretty good public school system. But now, according to the North Carolina Association of Educators, the state lags Alabama and Mississippi. Chris, is that an image that state leaders can afford to have if they want to continue to attract business and have a healthy economy?
You know, it's going to be tough, right? I mean, the old joke in the South for decades has been, thank God for Mississippi, right? The idea being that no matter what the metric is, Mississippi is always going to be worse. So you never want to be, you know, have Mississippi be the favorable part of the comparison. With that said, I think the Democrats and Republicans, especially Republicans, but Democrats too, have talked a lot about how North Carolina is consistently rated as the best state for business, right? And the state that entrepreneurs want to come to. So there seems to be some gap, right? On the one hand, we've got metric after metric after metric that says public education isn't doing well. People think that's going to translate into a lack of business development, lack of companies deciding to move here. What we're seeing really, though, has been the opposite.
State employees, Colin, are already slated to receive, I think, a 3% pay increase in the fall. What do you think the outcome of the governor's request for a 5% increase will be? And is that 5% on top of the 3 or just an additional 2?
My understanding is it's an additional 2. So, you know, this past year, state employees got, I think it was a 5% raise. The budget called for them in the second year of the budget cycle starting in July to get an additional 3% on top of that. The governor would like to see that up to 5%. You know, that's not a huge difference in what's being asked for there. But one thing we did hear from Senate Leader Phil Berger at the same time he was talking to reporters in the clip we just heard was the possibility of some kind of bonuses. The idea that if we've got the surplus, it's one-time money, maybe we top off that 3% with some kind of bonus for teachers and state employees that's a one-time deal rather than something the state has to pay for, you know, year after year after year. So that seems like that's going to be the tension point there is, are they willing to increase the long-term salaries of folks, or are they just willing to sort of, you know, give you a thank you check at, you know, Christmas or something that only is going to apply to this coming year? That seems to be the big question.
Part of the reason for all of these suggested raises and bonuses, particularly in education, is that school systems around the country have been having difficulty in both retaining and attracting people into the teacher workforce. But the same evidently is happening with other departments in the state government. The Chief Deputy Secretary for Health with the State Department of Health and Human Services told lawmakers this month that while there has been some improvement in state pay over the past year, wages are simply not competitive with the private sector. Mark Benton was speaking specifically at the time about the situation with the state psychiatric hospitals, but his comments have been echoed by leaders of other state agencies. So have state wages ever been competitive with the private sector? And in this post-pandemic economy, is this a reality that legislators will simply have to face, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the big concern is the State Employees Association lobbied for a much bigger raise than they got last year. I think they're going to lobby again this session to increase it much more than lawmakers are willing to pay. And then you have an argument for, I think we heard this from Senate Leader Phil Berger last year, of, oh, well, if we raise the pay too much, then we might, you know, exacerbate the labor market concerns in the private sector because so many people in the private sector are suddenly going to want to become state employees. You know, historically, as you mentioned, government work has never been, you know, where you go to get rich, but the sort of attractive aspect of it was you'll get this great health care system, you'll get great insurance, you'll get great benefits, great retirement, and that over long term will make it an attractive proposition. I think the degree to which people in the private sector now are trying to offer these additional perks to get people in the door when they're trying and struggling to find qualified workers, that sort of negates the you know, the value proposition that the state government's able to put out there. And people are just sort of looking at, well, what am I going to make in my first year at the job? And if it's a choice between a private sector job and a state government job, odds are the private sector job is going to pay you better, particularly in the short term. And that's a lot of what workers are looking for and that state's going to be struggling with going forward to fill these positions, because the vacancy rate really is across the board throughout state government a big problem at this point. And it's resulting in the workers that are still around doing double the work. Then they get burned out, then they leave. It's sort of this self-perpetuating cycle.
So, Chris, in addition to tidying up or tweaking the budget in this short session, there's a lot of legislation that just scattered all over in corners of the room, all over the building on Jones Street. And there are these things called crossover bills that they want to take a look at in this short session. What are crossover bills?
Yeah, crossover bills are bills that made it from one chamber to the other chamber before the crossover deadline. So every time they have one of these sessions, they say, hey, here's the crossover deadline. If a bill doesn't make it from chamber A to chamber B by the crossover deadline, it's dead until the next session. And so if it did, it is still alive in the biennial session. And so they put out a big list. You can actually find these online on the General Assembly website, a list of all the bills that are eligible to be brought up. And they are all over the map, right? Things like Fayetteville State University can only be called Fayetteville State University, right, is one of them that's in there. There's a new bill that was just brought up about pickleball diversity. We've got CBD stuff that Colin's done a great job covering lately. We've got a bunch of these local bills. Maybe we can talk more about those, but I think those don't get sometimes enough attention. There's the possibility that we're going to get some constitutional amendments that also might come up. I mean, there's a lot that made crossover. There's a lot that can still be introduced. And then you've got this possibility of constitutional amendments as well.
Talk about the local bills, because I know nothing about them.
Yeah. So local bills, I think, are really interesting. Like I said, we don't pay enough attention to them, probably because it just sounds boring, right? Half the audience just went to sleep when I said local bills. But these are
don't
bills.
Talk about them.
these are bills that only affect a very small number of places. A lot of times they're just not that important, right? They say, let's annex some small little piece of property. Who cares? But they go through pretty quickly usually. The key thing to know about local bills is they don't go to the governor's desk for veto, right? So even though Governor Cooper's veto may not be that powerful, he still gets to hold a press conference. Colin Campbell's going to come out and cover it, right? It's going to be a big deal. These local bills never make it to the governor's desk. So if you want to remake state government, a really good way to do it quietly is through a lot of local bills, one after the other after the other. And so one way in which that's happened in the last couple of sessions is by moving local elections in certain counties from nonpartisan to partisan affairs. And they've been doing this kind of one bill here, one bill there, one bill in another corner of the state. It never gets a lot of attention. It never goes to the governor's desk, but very slowly you can actually make a big change. And I would argue that actually has been a pretty big change to our state and is going to fundamentally change the kind of political party structure in our state moving forward.
One testing ground for new issues like the one piled yesterday about cryptocurrency mines banned in three counties. That's a big noise problem in some areas, and they haven't been able to get a statewide bill. So now there's an effort to do just three counties. So it's sort of an incremental approach to policy.
And the noise comes from the enormous amount of server power that these crypto mines take. And I guess it creates a lot of noise. One of the crossover bills that will get a lot of attention and has already gotten a lot of attention deals with illegal immigration and ICE. It's House Bill 10. Senate Leader Phil Berger's office has said he is in favor of dealing with that bill in the short session. Talk about what that bill would accomplish, Colin. I only have a minute.
Yeah, so this is about essentially when federal immigration authorities issue a detainer for someone who is in county jail somewhere that they think that, you know, maybe a candidate for deportation or some other charges. Some counties follow that. Others, particularly the urban counties like Charlotte-Mecklenburg, have made a decision not to go with that because they feel like that's a potentially, you know, due process rights infringement. This is a bill that's kicked around for several years, has been vetoed by Governor Roy Cooper multiple times, didn't quite get across the finish line last year. Now they're going to try again. As we mentioned earlier, they do have a veto-proof supermajority. So odds are this bill does get passed into law this year, and it's going to be up in committee in just a few minutes this morning.
And the reason that it's gotten opposition in Mecklenburg County is the same as the reason it's gotten opposition in other counties. Democratic sheriffs who identify as Democrats, have said no to cooperating with ICE with the particulars of this bill. This would force them to do that. We'll come back and talk more about that. We'll talk about one of the other bills that they're looking at, and that it deals with several bills, I think, with election security and child care and medical marijuana and more. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Chris Cooper joins us, professor of political science and public affairs and director of the Public Policy Institute at Western Carolina University. And Colin Campbell is Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC. We were talking about the crossover bill. But it may require cooperation of sheriffs around the state with ICE in certain elements. And it's been Democratic sheriffs primarily who have said, no, we don't want to do this. And they have said, Chris, that they don't want to do it because they think it will make the community less safe because they won't be trusted by people within the community. How do we know they're right?
You know, I don't think we do know that they're right. I mean, this is a tough one to empirically tease out, right? So I don't think this is a situation where we can say this person's right, this person's wrong. I think, like a lot of things in politics, not just today, but for a long time, it's a tension, right? And I think some of that tension is just inherent in this issue that we're talking about. You've got some of these Democratic sheriffs and certainly some of the Democratic lawmakers who think it's going to reduce trust. It's possible that they are absolutely correct, and it's also possible that some folks would grant that point and still say that the law should be passed. So I don't think this is one we're going to break through a lot of opinion. I think people are going to be pretty locked in. I think like a lot of issues today, it was a partisan decision where the opinions were locked in before people had even read the bill.
It's already illegal for non-citizens to vote in North Carolina. I think that's a nationwide law. You can't vote if you're not a citizen. But some conservatives here are pushing for a constitutional amendment to the state constitution to emphasize that voting as a non-citizen is illegal. Phil Berger says he doesn't see any harm in considering it if there's enough support. What would be the end result of including that in the Constitution? Would it make almost non-existent voting by non-citizens even more rare? What impact would it have?
This is definitely a sort of a red meat election year issue. What it reminds me of is we had a constitutional amendment a few years back guaranteeing you the right to hunt and fish, which, you know, who could be against hunting and fishing? That's a great old American pastime. This is kind of the same thing. It's sort of an issue that's designed to drive particularly Republican voters to the polls. You know, Republican voters often concerned based on what they hear in national media that there may be folks who aren't citizens who have somehow managed to get around existing laws and cast a vote in American elections. This is something that wouldn't have any practical effect because, as you mentioned, it's already illegal, but certainly something that might get Republicans to come out and vote if perhaps they're maybe not as thrilled about Donald Trump or Mark Robinson as their candidate choices. Perhaps they would be interested in coming out to show their support for only citizens can vote.
Chris, does it happen? Do we have non-citizens voting in any significant number that would even affect the outcome of an election for dog catcher?
Yeah, short answer, no, right? I mean, this doesn't happen. And even the people proposing the bill aren't saying that it happens a lot, right? So this is, it's like double secret probation, right? What's the difference between that and regular probation? I have no idea. And I have no idea how you make something super duper illegal. It's not going to change anything in any real way. Colin, actually, he and I were sharing a brain this morning because I was thinking of the very same vote on hunting and fishing a few years ago. I don't think that was a right that was about to be infringed upon, yet they decided to put it on a ballot. They thought that it could drive turnout. It plays with these larger kind of culture wars issues that dominate so much of what we're dealing with. So, no, I don't think it's going to matter. There is this interesting little proposal I've seen pop up a couple of places to perhaps tie this to a constitutional amendment to get the literacy test out of the North Carolina state constitution. If those were to be paired together, I think this could be actually a pretty interesting thing to watch, right? You've got two policies that fundamentally aren't going to change the way any one person votes, could matter symbolically. Perhaps that's a way to actually, for once, get two parties together. We'll see if that has any legs.
Nationally, one of the big issues for Republicans is election integrity or election security, despite the fact that there is no evidence of any meaningful problems in the last election. They're dwelling on it. Could that help? Executive Director of the North Carolina State Board of Elections, Karen Brinson Bell, and her efforts to get legislators to fund an update to the state's election information management system. She says, Colin, that it dates back to 1998, so it's like looking at an Atari game in the age of cell phones. Does she have their attention?
And I think there's an interest in doing something on this. The question is whether they want to fund the amount that she wants to fund. There's been issues with this in the past over partisan issues with some of these upgrades and new systems. There was a sort of nationwide system called ERIC that would allow different state board of elections in different states to sort of compare their records and establish when someone's moved to a different state, get them off the voter rolls in the place where they no longer live, things like that. And that got caught up in this sort of overall national partisan war where the group ERIC was perceived as being in some way partisan. There was a lot of suspicion from Republicans about what that was going to accomplish. And so they passed legislation to stop the State Board of Elections here in North Carolina from participating in that. So I think if Brinson Bell is able to make the case that whatever she's proposing in terms of a new and improved, better system, that there's not any sort of partisan fingers behind the scenes working on that, I think she can probably get the money. If there's sort of a conservative pushback to how she wants to do it, then that could derail the whole thing.
So this system handles everything from candidate filing to processing absentee ballots and everything in between. And I think her organization, the State Board of Elections, asked the legislature for $8 million. They only received $5 million. And she says, we've got an old house that needs to be refurbished. We'll get the foundation and the walls with the $5 million. But now we need the roof. So if you really believe in election integrity and security, can you say no to this request, Colin?
You know, I think it's hard to say no, especially when it's $3 million in a state that's got a $1 billion surplus, that this is only going to be a drop in the bucket over the overall, new spending that goes into this budget cycle. Yeah. So I think she's got a pretty good case here, and I don't see a huge amount of pushback to it. But again, you never know. There could be some sort of, conspiracy theory that gets out there and, derails it for one reason or another.
So, Chris, a new law that passed last year included most but not all of the Election Integrity Network's agenda. The Election Integrity Network is an organization founded by Cleta Mitchell. She is a lawyer who helped Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election.
That's right.
Its North Carolina leader, Jim Womack, told WRAL-TV that he'd like some additional changes. He wants to see the state's voter rolls cleaned up and give partisan poll observers access to mail-in ballots. Phil Berger has said that he would be hesitant to change any election laws in the middle of an election year because he has criticized Democrats for allegedly doing that in the past. How concerned should we be that they passed some of the agenda of an organization founded by someone who might have assisted Donald Trump in trying to overturn an election?
I mean, right, this is a question about how much the source matters versus how much the policy matters. I think every person has to decide that for themselves. But, we talked before about the nationalization of state politics, and that's what you're seeing. Cleta Mitchell has North Carolina connections, but she is not limited in what she's trying to do just to North Carolina. So I think folks have to decide for themselves how much that's going to matter. As far as this kind of general issue, right, House Bill 747, right, this is the jumbo jet bill from the long session, did, I think, accomplish most of what they wanted. Some of what was left was in this Bill 749, which is kind of held up in the courts, and that's the one that would have changed kind of the makeup of the State Board of Elections, the makeup of County Board of Elections, and some other things. I think it's going to be hard for them to get much more through, though, and sort of just to piggyback, too, on the conversation about funding. Let's remember that 747 included a lot of things. One was to say no more outside money towards elections. And so I think Karen Brinson Bell's argument, part of it anyway, is, hey, you told us we can't get money from other people. You need to then fund us directly. So I think that's maybe another piece of kind of evidence or ammunition that she has in trying to make this case.
And what do they mean by cleaning up voter rolls?
I think they are arguing, ironically, that when somebody moves to another state, that should be cleaned up quicker, that we should be getting rid of people who are no longer eligible to vote sooner. We do have a process to do this, right? And it's actually one of the cleanest in the country. It's also arguably the most accessible voter roll in the country. So you can go right now and with a couple of clicks and a big enough computer, download the entire state voter file. You could check every voter in the state if you felt like it. So of all the states to highlight, North Carolina is kind of an odd one because I think we do a much better than average job, and every metric I'm aware of would support that.
So aside from teacher raises and funding education and opportunity scholarships, and we've been talking about a lot of things that don't mean much to the average person. ICE, the cooperation of sheriffs with ICE, election security that we've been talking about. Here's something that does matter, and there was a big story on this yesterday in the national news about what's happening nationally with child care. The child care industry here and across the country has been working vigorously to raise awareness of what they see as a looming child care cliff. Grants came to them through the American Rescue Plan during the pandemic. Those grants will expire on June 30th, and a survey conducted by the North Carolina Child Care Resource and Referral Council discovered that without financial assistance from the legislature, nearly 30% of the state's child care centers are expected to close. Child care is already way too expensive for a lot of people. It's also not available for a lot of people. Is this one of the topics they're likely to address in this short session? And if so, are they likely to fund anything?
You know, I'm hearing interest in funding some degree of subsidies to make up for this loss of federal funding. You see a big push from the NC Chamber and the business community, because the big worry is if you lose access to childcare, if it gets more expensive, if a bunch of centers close, then those are people who can't join the workforce. They've got to stay home with their kids. And so you have more jobs that go unfilled. So this is a big, I think, economic development issue. And Republicans are likely to see that in a certain way. I don't think we're going to see quite as much money as Governor Roy Cooper put towards this particular subject in his budget. It may be a smaller amount. And the question is, does it go far enough to address the needs that these facilities have to keep their doors open, keep it affordable? I mean, it's already, you know, my kids in preschool right now, the cost of that is the same as my house payment every month. And if that goes up more, then that's more people who are priced out of being able to have access to childcare. So it's going to be a big concern, I think, for a lot of people. And this looming deadline with federal money makes it that much more imperative that something happens soon.
So we've been talking in the state about legalizing marijuana for medical uses for quite a while. Phil Berger says legalization remains a priority in the Senate, where a bill passed both in 2022 and 23 with bipartisan support, but never got a vote in the House. What is the status of that now? Is this something that the House might take up as a crossover bill in this short session?
You know, the House considered it pretty significantly last year and didn't quite get the votes they wanted on the Republican side to move that bill along, even though the Senate wanted it. One thing Berger brought up this time around is that he'd like to see some sort of compromise bill. The House last year passed new regulations for CBD and hemp products. These are products that contain THC, in many cases can have similar effects as marijuana, and are currently legal and unregulated. A 16-year-old can go to a gas station and buy this without getting carded. So the House would like to regulate those things. The House Majority Leader is now running a CBD and hemp company that would like to see these regulations passed. So Berger has floated this idea of, well, what if we legalize medical marijuana at the same time we put some regulations to control what's in these products that already exist and control who can get access to these products? And maybe that's some kind of happy medium on this issue that can get medical marijuana across the finish line. We'll just have to see if the House is willing to go for that kind of deal.
And in the shadow of October 7th and the attack by Hamas in Israel, House Speaker Tim Moore has said one of his goals is to pass legislation to, quote, really crack down on anti-Semitism and to define that as a hate crime in North Carolina. A bill was filed in the Senate last year that would define anti-Semitism in state law and provide protections against discrimination, including in employment and housing. Is it likely to gain traction in this short session, Colin?
I think it will. The Republicans definitely want to show their support for Israel in some fashion. And at the state level, you can't do a whole lot of that because we don't do a whole lot of foreign policy, not at the federal level. This will be, I think, an interesting issue to watch, just because the bill that was passed ties the definition of anti-Semitism to this outside groups definition, which is a lot broader than what you would expect. It includes the potential for including criticism of Israel as part of that definition of anti-Semitism. So there may be some free speech concerns that come along with this. We've seen similar bills in other states where it has become a fight over exactly how do you define anti-Semitism, particularly amidst the backdrop of all the protests we're seeing at different college campuses around the state, including UNC, with the arrest just this morning.
Very quickly, because we're out of time, the sports gambling was legalized in North Carolina this year, and even as the state continues to crack down on video gambling and these little machines that you find in various places, Tim Moore has said that he doesn't believe legalizing video gambling would be much of a leap, since we already have a lottery and scratch-offs and, of course, mobile sports betting. Phil Berger says there may not be enough time to pass this in the short session. However, Chris, how do you explain this about-face on gambling all of a sudden?
Cash on the barrelhead. I mean, I think this is really about, they think that there is money to be had, there is tax revenue to be gained, there is that at some point the genie's out of the bottle, right? So we might as well just have more of it. And, you know, I'm sitting here talking to you in Western North Carolina today, and I'm, what, 15 miles away from a place where we at least have some legalized marijuana in Cherokee. Also, we've had gambling for a good long time. And so mm-hmm. I think it's interesting that the rest of the state seems to be following what we're seeing the Eastern Band of the Cherokee do on a few of these issues.
And politically, this will be Tim Moore's last short session as Speaker of the House because he's running for Congress. Surely there are people jockeying for his position right now. How might that impact this impending short session, Chris?
You know, I think that's going to matter. It appears that there is some sort of a deal. Nothing's formal, right? But I think all signs point to Destin Hall becoming the new Speaker of the House. Colin can correct me on that, of course. But that's what I think we're hearing. There's a few folks whose names were mentioned, but they appear to have coalesced around Hall. Unless something changes, I think we're going to see probably a pretty easy transition.
Dr. Chris Cooper, who is the director of Public Policy Institute and a professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University, and Colin Campbell, who is sitting right now at the Capitol in their little studio there. He's the Capitol Bureau Chief for WUNC. Thank you both for the honor.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.